What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DeSebato, and this week we are going to talk about healthcare in the U.S. The pandemic has changed how millions of Americans get access to healthcare, so we took a look at the risks and opportunities created for the health insurance companies that we cover. And then we discuss one of the largest social bonds ever issued, which will have its proceeds used to support EU countries' efforts to keep workers in jobs during the pandemic. Thanks as always for joining us. Stay tuned. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 12.6 million people unemployed in the U.S. as of October 1st, and 886,000 people filed new claims for unemployment benefits last week, so that number is now likely past 13 million. That equates to about 8% unemployment, a pandemic low, but still a disaster. And that 8% is not evenly spread throughout our society for a variety of reasons. Unemployment rates among Black or African American and Hispanic or Latino populations and Asian populations are higher than for white people. Take into account the fact that COVID-19 has disproportionately hurt minority companies and that a majority of people get their health care through their employers, and you have an extremely dire situation on your hands. Now, people listening outside the U.S. might be sensical and thinking, what do you mean when you say people get their insurance through their employers? Well, what I mean is, in the U.S., employers are the direct customers of insurance companies, the companies that make American medicine affordable. And if you are a U.S. listener nodding to this like, okay, I get the point, well, here's the thing, you all-knowing patriot. Insurance companies rely on companies to pay the premiums that are in effect the insurance company's revenue. So what happens to an insurance system, to a medical system, when a society that has millions unemployed during a pandemic and cannot afford health insurance even though they need it? Because, you know, it's a viral pandemic. Well, that is exactly what we are going to talk about today. What's happening to insurance companies during COVID-19? Before we get into how the system is changing because of COVID, I should note we aren't going to discuss the human toll that this pandemic has taken, nor are we going to get into the discussion about whether healthcare is a human right that should be available to all. If you want to discuss that later, DM me. I'm into it. I want to talk about it. I'm here for you to listen. But today we are going to only focus on what is happening in the insurance industry because there are shifts that you listeners should be aware of. To help me out with this, I called up my colleague Julia Jaguer, who just finished a research project on this very subject. And I called her up and I wanted her first to kind of guide me through all the actors involved in the U.S. healthcare system, because if you don't live in it, some of the truths can sound a bit odd.
Yes. So you're absolutely right. The value chain is really distinct in the U.S. And there are, I would say you could think about it, there are really three factors that come into play. There's firstly the product flow, which is the medicines and the drugs. Then there's the financial flow. And thirdly, there's contractual relationships.
All those factors keep the wheels turning in the U.S. Let's say you need to get a prescription filled at a pharmacy. Well, around the world, pharma companies make their own special drugs, send those drugs to a wholesaler that then sends it to your local pharmacy where you can go buy it. The big difference in the U.S. compared to other industrialized countries is you have an insured person and you have an uninsured person. If you're an uninsured person, boy, that price for that drug is hitting you directly. And drugs can be very expensive. For example, remdesivir, the antiviral drug just approved by the FDA today to fight COVID. One treatment of remdesivir costs a bit more than $3,000. And if you're unemployed and have to pay that, it's not good. But an insured person goes into the pharmacy and pays a fraction of what the drug costs. And the pharmacy deals with the insurance company to get the remaining cash needed to pay off the drug wholesaler. In the U.S., there are really only three ways you can get insurance. First, your company pays for it, like I said earlier. Or you pay for it yourself on the open market, aka Obamacare, which is getting challenged at the moment, by the way. And then you hopefully have a compensation plan with your employer.
The second is Medicaid, which is exclusively for low-income individuals. And the third is Medicare, which is health insurance for the elderly. So the way that an insurance company works is it all comes down to, you know, the original payer, right? So you have, for example, the government at a state or federal level, or the employer or individual paying for these medical costs.
And so insurance companies have these things called members. I'll use myself as an example. I currently have insurance through my employer, but I'm not really a member. I really am part of this group called MSCI. And MSCI contracts with this company, and they are the member that pays the premium on my behalf so I can be insured. Except what if I say something lame on this podcast and I was fired from MSCI ESG Research? Well, I'd be kicked out of the group, and my membership would be revoked, I'd be uninsured, and the insurance company would no longer get revenue from MSCI on my behalf. And so that is what is happening a million more times all over the US at the moment. And it's creating quite the situation for the insurance industry.
You know, I think amid COVID, there are really two key risks that we wanted to focus on. And the first is economic dislocation. And the second one is service quality.
Economic dislocation is the reduced insurance coverage due to job losses caused by the pandemic. It's basically what I just told you about before Julia set her 1-2 there. The service quality risk that she mentioned is a bit more varied. You have to pay attention to something more than just who is or is not employed.
One of the key things that we look at is the rapid acceleration of things like telemedicine and telehealth, which has obviously taken a shape of its own throughout COVID and has really accelerated, but also includes things like patient billing allegations and different technologies. So like drug pricing tools, capabilities that patients have via mobile applications. So, you know, how easily can they schedule a physician? And because insurance companies have different buckets of these product mixes for which they rely on for their premiums, we can see how they are shifting over time and which companies could potentially be more resilient to either, number one, capture those Medicaid, those employees falling into the Medicaid category. And then on the flip side, you know, companies will face a fall or a drop in those, you know, employer-sponsored plans because they'll see, you know, lower numbers of people and memberships within those commercial employer sponsored plans.
So I know that's a lot of insurance jargon to take in, but it's important to know right now for investors because it is the ESG risk that's being created for the industry as a whole because of COVID. What Julia is saying is there are insurance companies that take better care of their members than others. There are companies that offer a diverse suite of consumer access capabilities and technology interfaces, such as drug pricing tools, comprehensive telemedicine offerings, and smartphone capabilities. And it's the companies that do this well that are likely going to retain their customers and maybe get selected by a local government for its Medicaid insurance company, or an individual that is buying emergency insurance on the open healthcare market will likely select the company that offers better membership services. You can already see which insurance companies are at risk solely based on their 2019 membership percentages. Companies like Molina and Centene have a majority of their members enrolled through government programs, while companies like United Healthcare, Cigna, and CVS Health all rely on employee-sponsored plan members. Those are the companies most at risk as the unemployment numbers continue to climb in the U.S. It's not that government insurance plans are safer for the insurer, for the person like you or me. It's more so that insurance companies that have more government contracts are likely going to continue to collect premiums from its members, even as unemployment rises, especially as unemployment rises. What is also interesting is Julia found that the companies with more government-sponsored members actually score higher on that membership service metric. They have lower allegations of poor coverage, access and billing practices, and they provide more tools for insurers who are sick, like the telemedicine stuff, the doctor on demand, mobile applications that I was talking about, and they provide more transparency around drug pricing. And there's a reason there's a big difference between insurance companies and what they offer and how they offer it. All this information is really difficult to find out in the US. Julia is just really good at her job. In the US, the normal person doesn't really have a great way to compare insurance companies. Obamacare tried to fix this, but due to a variety of politically motivated reasons, it didn't really change much. And this lack of transparency is creating a long-term structural risk for the U.S. healthcare industry as a whole. The U.S. system, at the moment, has the highest cost and the lowest performance in terms of health outcomes, compared to 11 other industrialized nations, as shown by a study by Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And as the healthcare system continues to take on weight and perform poorly, there is a risk its poor reputation might one day affect how the industry is structured.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, insurance companies face a massive reputational risk. And I think that's not just for health insurance companies, right? Like the whole healthcare sector, you know, even the companies that are providing solutions, I think it's being watched very closely how insurance companies navigate those challenges. And, you know, if you just, you know, Google one of the bigger health insurance companies, you'll see that they have various different cost plans and affordability plans. Right. So yes, absolutely. They do face that, you know, brand risk, and some are managing it well, and others might not be managing it well. But that is, you know, absolutely a risk that we would be looking at, and especially in terms of like different various service quality and consumer and patient allegations that arise throughout that period.
In the EU, a new bond issuance was met with frenzied demand after it was announced its proceeds would help EU member states stave off unemployment due to the pandemic, and that it was offering abnormally high yields for bonds at the moment. This meant that investors placed bids for more than 275 billion USD, far exceeding the 20 billion USD of bonds on offer. It was one of the largest social bonds ever issued, and its sale was the first under the EU's SURE program that was set up to help alleviate poverty in the EU caused by the pandemic. To discuss this, I have with me Kevin Kwok, a colleague that studies the ESG fixed income market. So Kevin, I asked you to be here because last year, all we really talked about were green bonds, or the bonds that would use proceeds to fund environmentally friendly projects, because that market was booming and we had to discuss it. And it seems like this year is the year of the social bond. Do you agree with that? Is that kind of setting the frame, Will?
Yeah, so this is actually the first year where social bonds surpassed green bonds. And actually, social bonds almost doubled this year because of the pandemic. As it going forward, will social bonds continue to surpass green bonds? I don't know about that. I think it's mainly because of this COVID pandemic that has it really launched this effort. Social bonds typically are a little bit harder to measure, where when you think about a green bond, you do think of energy efficiency or renewable energy like solar panels or wind turbines. But for social bonds, it really does encompass a larger landscape. So you can think about gender equality, you can think about health and well-being, poverty, and communities. So it really has a larger landscape where right now when it comes to reporting, it actually is a little bit more difficult. Even on the green side, it's not as easy to report the impact metrics as well.
So what sort of outcomes can happen when it's difficult to report on the efficacy of a bond?
It's not necessarily the risks tied to it. It's more when they talk about the use of proceeds, I think for the green projects, it's a little bit more clear in a way where if you say, I'm going to use $100 million, use the proceeds to build solar panels or to build a wind turbine and a wind farm, then it's a little bit more specific. But for social, I think people are still trying to figure out the metrics, but that's where this bond is a little bit different, where the $17 billion is tied to two specific SDGs, and I think primarily the SDG 3 about good health and well-being, and also SDG 8, it's really targeting and designed to prevent and alleviate unemployment. But, you know, like green bonds, you know, there is always a worry about greenwashing. So similarly for social bonds, there is social washing as well. So having these indicators from the SDGs would be very helpful for them.
And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Julia and Kevin for joining me to discuss this week's news with an ESG twist. And I wanted to thank you so much for listening. As always, don't forget to rate and review us. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I really appreciate that. Thanks as always, and talk to you next week.
The MSCI ESG Research podcast is provided by MSCI Inc.'s subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research LLC, a registered investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or a promotion or recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.